The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, December 2nd, 2016. Keep the conversation going on Facebook and have a great weekend.
One thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. A post-truth political world, is that the era we've entered?
Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half-full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, more of facts.
That's the voice of Scotty Hughes, a ubiquitous Donald Trump surrogate on cable news, appearing on the Diane Rehm show yesterday, saying there's no such thing as facts anymore. Get used to it. It's the screeching cry of authoritarianism you're hearing there. Nothing is really true. Facts are what you want them to be. Truth is what we say it is. Well, luckily there are facts. We'll have lots of them on the show today, and hopefully some truth too. And here's a fact to start us off. 2,000 veterans, including Hawaii Congresswoman and vet Tulsi Gabbard, are headed to North Dakota on Sunday to join protesters who've been fighting the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline for months. They're set to arrive just before a Monday deadline set by North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple for protesters to evacuate. Anyone who remains could be prosecuted for trespassing. We reached out to both the governor's office and the Army Corps of Engineers to invite them on the show as well. Michael Wood Jr. is among the veterans headed to North Dakota. He's a former Marine Corps sergeant and a retired Baltimore City police sergeant, and he believes that the Standing Rock protests represent the grievance of many groups across the country, bound by one common cause.
No matter what perspective you have, if you're a libertarian, then you have the government trampling over your land rights. You have them telling you what you're going to do, where you're going to camp out. If you are a progressive, then you're worried about us not following science and doing the right thing. If you are involved in environmental concerns, you don't want a pipeline rupturing and endangering water. If you're a conservative and you're worried about big government, then you have what's now tens of millions, but it's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars in the total concept of the taxpayers in Marsden paying, so that money would be directly focused towards those few people that are getting the profits from the pipeline's oil going through. Because at this point, we don't have anything that's going to help and benefit anybody else. The truck drivers that we're transporting are losing their jobs. The land is being taken over. Burial grounds are being trumped. And we're having actual legitimate arguments in this country, whether this is the first time, second time, or third time we have stolen the land of the Native American people. So when you see that we have taxpayer-funded, put in uniform, badges on them, spraying water cannons on peaceful protectors, you can clearly see who the violent side of the exchange is.
I think that would surprise a lot of people to hear coming from you, because as I said, you are a former cop, a Baltimore City cop yourself.
So here's the thing. When you have all these vets and you have cops and firefighters coming up here, and these are people that have been in the system, why do you think we're so motivated to go and do this? We have seen the system. We know what it's like. For me personally, I don't know what it is about us, the way our country is fabricated. What they ended up doing is they take us poor kids, essentially, put us into the military, train us to kill brown people in the sands of the Middle East for oil, and we feel like that wasn't serving and protecting the people that we joined the military to do. And then I get out of the military, go into policing, and then I watch as the system of policing continues to train us to injure, imprison, and kill brown people for, again, the profits of oil. American policing is completely different from anywhere else in the entire world. It is built off of three things and three things only. It is the creation and maintenance of a slave class of people, whether that was the original slavery or that is the new Jim Crow mass incarceration type of slavery. It is is the protection of elite and white property. So that's why when the CVS burns, people watch that over and over and want to know why those people are burning down the building and forgetting the fact that Freddie Gray was just thrown into the new Jim Crow and wiped off this planet. And we're talking about a CVS burning. So that's the protection of elite property. And the continued genocide of the Native American people is the third aspect. And everywhere you see policing act, you will see one of those three or a combination of those three things enacted. And that is not what we serve to do. We did this and we tried to sacrifice and tried to be heroes because we wanted to protect people and serve our country, not to serve the profits of capitalism in an oligarchy.
Michael Wood, did you feel this way politically when you were in the Marine Corps, when you were in the Baltimore City Police Department, or is this view of politics something that came to you after you left?
Okay, so, I mean, I'm a white kid from the suburbs. I grew up conservative. I voted for Bush and Romney, and it takes a long time and a long progression to realize what your actions are actually doing. Not what people say, but what are the policies and institutions making you do? So in policing, I acted with complete racism and hurt the people of that community. But I wasn't doing that as a racist. I wasn't doing that consciously. It's these systems that we have developed because our society is really based off of those three things. And policing just encapsulates it all into one area where we can see it because the intensity and the authority of the exchanges exposes its real root.
Now, your group had originally intended to attract about 500 vets to go to North Dakota. Those numbers have swelled now to 2,000. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that is a good problem, I suppose. But on my end, of this calculation with logistics and getting people up there, it's a good problem to have. But boy, am I surprised by the overwhelming response. I shouldn't have been. I feel like I was naive, thinking I was the only veteran, and it was just me and Wes that were having these thoughts run through our mind that tells you about how we can get in our own little bubbles, and there is a tremendous amount of us. We have to say, stop, please.
So what are the practicalities after you go to North Dakota on Sunday? What are you planning to do physically? What does it look like there? What are you going to do once you're there?
Our mission is one of support. It is not for anything my agendas or what I want to do or what any other veteran in this organization wants to do. We are there to serve the people and the various tribes there for what they need set up. And maybe that doesn't end up being exactly what we want it to be, but that doesn't matter. We are servants of the people and we will protect and serve them as they request. We have supplies built up to make the camp better. We have communication things to improve as much as we can. And we have different ideas that we're not going to talk about quite publicly.
Michael Wood, what do you think is more important, if one of them is more important, for the cause here with what you're doing? Is it that you and veterans, and you're a former cop, a former Marine, have real practical building, organizing, survival skills that can help out there? Or is it the optics, the symbolism of 2,000 military veterans, some of them cops and firefighters like you, going in solidarity with Native American people?
Well, of course, nothing is ever mutually exclusive when it comes to motivations, just like we have a whole bunch of different motivations for being here. Apparently, the veteran presence has done a lot for the media and to draw more attention to it, and that's completely good. For a situation like this, our ability as military members to be self-sufficient is what I think is truly critical. We can't be going there and relying on the other people to support us. Right now, I think the biggest thing is that I don't think this is going to stop here. I think we're going to ride this out until we win this. And we have such a tight group of people that really care about changing this country so that it's better for their children that, you know, this looks like a lot of work ahead of us going forward. And I think we're really going to build something bigger.
Michael Wood is a former Marine sergeant, a retired Baltimore City police officer, and is heading with about 2,000 other veterans to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota to assist in the protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Michael Wood Jr., thank you for your time.
It's an honor talking to you. I appreciate it.
We are going to appoint Mad Dog Mattis as our Secretary of Defense. But we're not announcing it till Monday, so don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody. There's Donald Trump at a thank you rally last night in Cincinnati, announcing retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, known as Mad Dog, as his choice to be the next Secretary of Defense if he's confirmed by the Senate. Now, Mattis retired from the military in 2013. The law requires 7 years to pass between military service and taking on civilian leadership of the Defense Department. And that means James Mattis needs Congress to change that law for him. Republicans like John McCain, who heads the Senate Armed Services Committee, are fine with doing that. New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand says she isn't, and she's going to vote against that. But Mattis appears to be headed for a job now in two parts. One, balancing Donald Trump's inexperience and temperament, and two, exerting a worldview through the might of the U.S. military. David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy.
Mattis is precisely the kind of person you want to have next to a neophyte president like Donald Trump, and also a president like Donald Trump seems likely to be, which is one who is temperamentally a little volatile. Let's put it that way. Mattis is career military, highly respected, highly experienced, has seen every kind of situation that there is tough. You know, ran into trouble with the Obama administration because he spoke his mind. When I think what we really need next to a guy like Trump is a grown-up who's going to sit there and say, no, sir, that's wrong. I have a different point of view, and is going to feel comfortable providing that kind of direct advice. He's got that. He's got the respect of the military around him. Of all of Trump's picks, and I personally believe many of those picks have been pretty dubious, this one is far and away the best. And I think Mattis is somebody who can give people some confidence in the future direction of the administration, provided he actually has influence and is respected. Now, as far as his worldview goes, you know, he's a Marine, and he comes at this with the point of view of somebody who has seen the conflicts in the Middle East, and he has very strong views on the situation there. He was the commander of CENTCOM for a couple of years, which is our military command there. The reason he got into trouble with the Obama administration is he was very uncomfortable with their Iran policy, very uncomfortable with the Iran deal, and sees Iran as the principal threat in the region. I think that's one of the reasons Trump was drawn to him.
So David Rothkopf, somebody who is as suspicious toward Iran as Mattis has proven, has also signaled that he's against what Donald Trump has said he's for, which is tearing up the Iran nuclear deal. He said that he's for strict enforcement of the terms, but not for going back on it. Is he a realist when it comes to the Middle East?
Well, you know, I'm always a little skeptical of terms like realist because, you know, they're created by people to define themselves as being realistic and everybody else as being unrealistic.
Indeed.
But he, I think, is... He's honest, he's straightforward, and he's sensible. And it would be silly to take a deal like the Iran deal, which has some benefits to it, and tear it up. Rather, take advantage of the benefits, identify the areas you see as weak spots, enforce in those areas, and also send a message to Iran that, you know, we as a country are not just concerned with your nuclear capability. If you're meddling in other countries in the region, if you through Hezbollah are a threat to Israel, if you are undermining stability or committing bad acts in places like Syria, we are going to stand up to that as well. And we are not going to abandon our other allies. I think that one of the things that Obama did was pursue the Iran deal with such vigor that he left those other allies feeling unloved. And I think Mattis is somebody who can come in and bring a bit of stability and sensibility to policies there.
James Mad Dog Mattis, the Marine General Commander of CENTCOM. His uniform is off, and he'll put on that black suit that is the new uniform of the Secretary of Defense if he's confirmed by the Senate. David Rothkopf, CEO and editor of Foreign Policy. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's Todd Zwillick. Welcome back. Facts, we're just basking in them here today on The Takeaway. Here's another one. Donald Trump scored an early political win this week. The president-elect struck a deal with Carrier, the heating and air conditioning company, to keep 1,000 jobs in Indiana that it was planning to move to Mexico. So here are the facts of the deal, as far as we know them anyway. It'll cost the government about $7 million worth of tax breaks over a decade, and Carrier is still moving another 1,000 jobs to Mexico. If that sounds a little bit like a taxpayer-subsidized solar industry, like the infamous Solyndra, or a little bit like President Obama's auto bailout, Well, it should. They're similar. It's not quite the promise Donald Trump made to punish companies that ship jobs out of the U.S. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump said he would do the same for the coal industry, which lost 12% of its jobs last year. His message resonated in coal-heavy states like West Virginia and Kentucky, where 6,900 coal jobs across the state is the lowest total in 118 years. Here's retired Kentucky coal miner Ruby Couch, who we're going to talk to in just a few minutes.
Hillary Clinton gets up there, especially this year, and says she's going to raise taxes on the middle class, and she's going to put coal miners out of work. I just can't see any coal miner biting the hand that feeds them.
It's been a long, long decline for coal. The industry's lost about 150,000 jobs since 1980. It's also been a drastic slide for Democrats in coal country. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Mid-Atlantic Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times, and she traveled to the town of Williamson, West Virginia, to figure out how the Democratic Party lost coal country so dramatically.
You know, West Virginia is a really good place to see how the Democratic Party really has lost the white working class. That's exactly what happened in West Virginia. It went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, in large part, I think, on the strength of his promises to put miners back to work, but also his pledge to appoint the conservative Supreme Court justices.
You know, you wrote in your piece a passage that really caught my eye. It said, "It's difficult for outsiders to fathom how deeply faith and work are intertwined here, or the economic and psychological depression that sets in when an entire region loses the only livelihood many of its people have ever known."
You know, Todd, I wrote that passage from the heart. I really think that it sums up my experience. So many people, so many critics of Trump, Hillary supporters will say, those people are fools. They don't know anything. They're ignorant hillbillies. Why don't they just leave and go find work somewhere else? These are people who are very deeply tied to the land. Many people have lived in these mountains for generations. Their families have been there for generations, not only in West Virginia, but in eastern Kentucky. Mining is the only work many of them have ever known and their families have ever known, and it's provided good jobs, and it's gone away for a variety of reasons. Economic forces, the decline in the price of natural gas, coupled with President Obama's environmental rules. But suffice to say, those jobs are gone, and people are in deep, deep pain. So many of the people I met are working so hard and are struggling. And faith does play a role in their lives.
So the pain is real, but warnings are already out there, as you said, that many of the jobs that Trump promises in coal and other industries aren't coming back. How do people react when they know that news? Is there a reality that's 4 years deferred here, or do they have a real hope that coal could come back?
I don't think the people have a real hope that coal will come back the way it once was. And I want to actually share with you, Todd, the story of one woman I met in coal country. She's a waitress at the Huddle House. Her minor husband lost his job in coal last year. Ever since, she's been working three jobs. Not only is she a waitress, but she is also part-time teaching and cooking at the school. And in addition to that, when her husband lost his job, she took an opportunity for miners' wives to retrain as a phlebotomist. So she did that retraining, but by the time she became a phlebotomist, there were so many miners' wives who had already done the training that the phlebotomy market was flooded. Her father was a miner, too. He's also lost his job, and the only reason they still have their house was because they saw this mining downturn coming, and they saved. So many people like this have seen their families move away in search of better jobs. They've seen their children move away. And these people wonder, why didn't the Democrats who ran things see the coal bust coming? Why didn't they work harder to diversify? So there's both a realistic sense about jobs and a deep anger at politicians that I think actually predates President Obama.
And then the question, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, for any Democrat listening to our conversation is, how do they go back to a place like West Virginia and speak to these people whose jobs and livelihoods have left them and reconnect their politics with their real lives?
You know, I think that is going to be very difficult, as Hillary Clinton found out. when you really drill down on what people believe, their policies, on energy at least, are not that different from what Hillary Clinton was articulating. Many of these miners and, you know, mine industry folks also feel that the Democratic Party is completely antithetical to their beliefs. You really need to think about that component of faith. Here you have people who are church-going people, who are Christians, who are embracing Donald Trump, who is a trash-talking, thrice-married man who's a Manhattan billionaire. I mean, he couldn't be any farther from the culture of these people than, you know, than a man on the moon.
And who wasn't Christian himself, really, to any appreciable degree until extremely recently.
Exactly. And so I found when I asked that question, how can you embrace this man? And over again, people gave me a variation of this. They would say, God has used unjust people to do his will. Or as one person said to me, I figure there's only one perfect leader.
So it's the economic question and the interaction of work with that faith that's changed, because Republicans figured out 40 years ago how to mix Christian faith with voting, and that didn't flip West Virginia to them. That was a Democratic state, but it is no longer.
Yes, and don't forget, the Democrats in West Virginia were never Democrats like the Democrats in San Francisco or Massachusetts. They were the old conservative blue dog Democrats that you and I used to run into on Capitol Hill, who pretty much don't exist anymore.
Cheryl Stolberg, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Mid-Atlantic Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. And now to someone who's seen the loss of mining jobs firsthand. Ruby Couch spent his entire 35-year career underground as a coal miner in eastern Kentucky near Whitesburg. Ruby, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, describe your career as a coal miner. You're retired now.
Yes, I've been retired for about 3 years, but November the 8th, 1976 was my first day underground, and I actually worked for Amanda Coal Company, but a lot of things, Todd, that people don't understand about coal miners is they are highly trained. In 1984, after about, I don't know, 5-6 years in the coal mine, I actually achieved my mine foreman certificate, and that helped me a lot because for 20 years I was a mine foreman, and so I've had a long career, but I enjoy teaching people what I have learned through the years.
So you managed to get to the end of your career, you know, and have a normal retirement, but many, many people haven't done that. Can you talk about how many of those jobs are left and sort of what your town and what your area is like, maybe compared to 30 years ago?
Well, I will tell you, compared to probably 10 years ago, our coal mining, I worked for Golden Oak Mining Company, which was a big company, and they were actually putting out $4 million a month. And when you jerk $4 million a month out of an economy, I mean, that takes money away from Walmart and school and just grocery stores and just different things.
So, Ruby Couch, did you vote for Donald Trump?
I did.
And what's your hope about what he can do for coal jobs? Like, I mean, the slide in mining employment accelerated under President Obama, but this goes back, as you know. I mean, in 1980, there were 228,000 miners employed in this country. Today, there's 80,000. I mean, this demand is way, way down. This industry has been changing for decades and decades.
Well, I'll tell you what, right now, I've actually had a couple men approach me with the last little bit wanting to get their mine retraining because they are very optimistic about the fact that Mr. Trump is going to try to remove some of the regulations that the EPA and Obama has imposed upon the coal industry, that they've actually talked about going back into the mines, and we've heard rumors around that coal mines are going to be starting back.
Of course, Ruby Couch, it's impossible to have this conversation without talking about climate change. Climate change is a real thing. Sea levels are already rising. What do you think we should do about it?
Well, one thing that he was proposing to do about climate change, I've been listening a little bit about climate change. I don't know that much about it, but I don't know, they talk about the oceans are rising and the things are getting warmer. But as far as climate change, I think Donald Trump has some good policies.
But you think the federal government should be doing something to curb carbon? You think climate change is a real thing? I mean, there's got to be a balance here, right, between jobs like yours, which are critical, and stemming the rise in global temperatures, which is also critical.
Right. You're exactly right. But I'm going to tell you, I think we have the technology in place that we could put scrubbers on those coal-fired plants, and we could reduce the carbon emission the way it's supposed to be. Plus, at the same time, we could mine our coal a lot cheaper. I don't understand buying coal from China or Russia and from different places when we have the resources right here at home.
All right. So, Ruby Couch, we're going to let you go. But, you know, Donald Trump is now a politician. I know that you voted for him and that you support him, but you're also waiting for the facts, and you're probably a little bit skeptical. What's the timeline? You know, when do you need to see more jobs in your county or the eastern part of your state to know if he's the real deal?
I'll tell you what, if he will do anything, I want to say within the first 10 months, then we'll know that he is the real deal and things are really going to start picking up again.
And if he's not?
Then we'll know that too, because he's got 4 years, and then we'll have to think about someone else.
Ruby Couch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
Ruby Couch, former coal miner in eastern Kentucky, retired after 35 years.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Election year. The last ghostly patch of snow slips away. With it, winter's peaceful abandon melts into a memory, and you remember the mire of muck just outside your kitchen window is the garden you've struggled and promised to keep. Jeans dyed black by years of dirt, you step into the ache of your boots again. Clear dead spoils, trowel the soil for new life.
That's the poet and author Richard Blanco reading his poem Election Year. In 2013, Richard Blanco became the first Latino, the first immigrant, and the first openly gay inaugural poet, reading his poem One Today at President Obama's second inauguration. Richard Blanco's mother left Cuba voluntarily in the late 1960s when she was 7 months pregnant with Richard, and he grew up in the Cuban expat community in Miami. He joined us to talk about the death of Fidel Castro, who'll be buried in a ceremony on Sunday.
To be honest with you, in some ways it felt a little anticlimactic in the sense that that's something the community has sort of been thinking about for a while. And of course, there's been a transfer of power already. But it is a significant sort of psychological victory in the sense that I think there's a new kind of hope, or at least not hope, but maybe new possibilities are possible, because it does mark the end of sort of an era for the exile community. But of course, there's still a lot to do with Cuba. And then the irony, of course, of how we're here in the United States have also sort of transferred or about to transfer power to someone who in some ways has very similar kinds of rhetorics that the people are not all the people are sort of on board with.
And there's a part in that poem where you're fighting back the vines, you're pulling the weeds, you go to sleep, and a vine can come out and ruin a lot of your work or choke off a lot of your flowers. Authoritarianism?
Yes. I mean, in a sense, you know, it's all those layers. I mean, and, you know, a garden, just like a social construct, is in some ways an artifice, right? I mean, we're still trying to figure out what a democracy is or how it best works. But it's really about the idea that that it's our responsibility also and our role to keep on top of the garden. And that's constant work. Anybody that has a garden knows that. I live up here in the middle of a forest in Maine. And, you know, you turn your back for 1 minute and something will take over. And so, but also the idea of trusting that that's just part of the process, right? That we have to sort of push back in a way. Sometimes the garden is a bloom and everything's working fine, but you never know.
And I've noticed over the last week, of course, since the announcement of the death of Fidel Castro, that news has been this litmus test, right? Not only for Cuban Americans, but for Americans across the spectrum, how you react to Castro's death is supposed to say a lot about you, how you view not only Cuba, but how you view authoritarianism or how you view democracy or how you view political speech. You know, there's this acid test that we're going through now.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And when you see some of the political leaders around the world sort of sending these messages of, I guess, of mourning or condolences or whatnot, you find it interesting how different perspectives can be, right? And what's happening in Miami is another example of just that contrast of people like in the streets and sort of, I wouldn't say, you know, again, I don't think they're praising someone's death, but it is symbolic in the sense of an end of an era and what a different perspective they have of what Cuba is. And then you have, the people in Cuba, which I think there are many people from the early days of the revolution that the revolution really did change their lives and are in a different space of mourning right now than other communities. So, yeah, it really speaks to how complex our human beings can be.
Well, back to the garden before we let you go, Richard Blanco. I mean, it's winter now. It's December. You don't know exactly what the garden is going to look like in the springtime when things start to bloom. You have hopes for it. So, you know, let some months go by. How do you think Cuba's going to look in another 6 months or even another 5 years?
I really hope, and I think, and this is, you know, in some ways, as I said, it was kind of anticlimactic, Castro's death. In another way, it was very symbolic. What I do hope, and I've heard talk of this already, is that it was such a symbolic end, right? That I hope that some of sort of the moderate or less hardliner Cuban American community can maybe involve themselves in some of the efforts that the president has been doing to connect with Cuba, to reestablish relationships with Cuba and help him in these last few weeks. And depending on what Trump and what Trump does, which of course is always a wild card. And I'm also hoping that Raul Castro himself has a little more leeway now to perhaps make some of the changes that it seemed he was ready to make. As we all remember, after Obama went to Cuba, sort of Fidel Castro put on his jumpsuit and went to the Congress and told them, no way, right? And I think that put sort of a wrench in some of the things that that the two countries are trying to speak to.
It seems to me, in a way, that's about seeing who's going to put on their gloves, get some calluses, get out there and get their knees dirty.
Yeah, and see what happens in the spring and see how many weeds come come up or not. All we can do is sort of tend the garden, you know, and try to be. And that's what I try to do as an artist as well, is to use my work as a way of as a way of tending the garden, of making sure those weeds are called out, so to speak.
Richard Blanco, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Blanco is a poet and author, most recently of The Prince of Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. He was also the first immigrant, the first Latino, and the first openly gay inaugural poet.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to the emergency line of the San Angeles Police Department. If you prefer an automated response, press 1 now.
No guns, no foul language, no red meat.
Land of the free.
Dallas Multipass.
You know how it is. Bump into each other, sparks happen. Anyway, friend love.
Friday is movie day here on The Takeaway. You know that when we talk about new releases coming out. Rafer Guzman is the man that does that for us. He's film critic for Newsday and our Takeaway movie. Are you a maven now? What are you?
You want to call me a maven, a doyen?
Master, movie master. The big release this week, Rafer, is Jackie. You know, this is one of these great ideas that takes one piece of a story that we're familiar with, right?
That's right.
And expands it into a film. I do have trivia for you, by the way, before we get to this. Since we're talking about the Kennedys, hold on to this. We'll come back to the answer.
Okay.
You should know this one. This is the intersection of the Kennedys and the movies. Which JFK aide, John F. Kennedy aide, later became president of the Motion Picture Association of America? That's your question. If you know it, you can tweet me at Todd Zwillick if you want. If you think you know the answer, I think you people should know that one. Now, Jackie, Natalie Portman stars as Jackie Kennedy, right? Peter Sarsgaard, who I love, is in this. Let's listen to a clip.
Mr. Valenti, would you mind getting a message to all our funeral guests when they land?
Of course.
Inform them that I will walk with Jack tomorrow, alone if necessary. And tell General de Gaulle that if he wishes to ride in an armored car or in a tank for that matter, I won't blame him. And I'm sure the tens of millions of people watching won't either.
And she's really got that accent down, hasn't she?
She does indeed. This is one Long Islander playing another. Natalie Portman from Syosset, Jackie Kennedy from the Hamptons. This takes a look at Jackie in the days immediately following the assassination of JFK. So you're capturing her at her most raw, her most vulnerable. I think the director, Pablo Larraín, Chilean director, wanted to make something besides a traditional biopic. So he goes for a kind of impressionistic, disjointed kind of movie that jumps back and forth in time. It's an ambitious approach, but I think it kind of renders Jackie herself pretty erratic. It's kind of hard to follow her character as she goes through these various dips in mood, you know, from being wounded and vulnerable to being combative, a little bit even sort of ruthless, as you heard there in that clip. And even though I think that Portman's got the mannerisms down, the accent, the way she holds her cigarette, everything, you know, the hair, she looks the part, I just never quite feel like I'm being let into the real Jackie to actually see what's behind that image that I already know.
It is an opportunity also for really great period piece filmmaking, right? The famous clothes, costumes, the famous cars and all that.
Yeah, and one of the best things actually is the recreation of the White House tour, the televised tour she gave in 62. That footage is great, and actually Portman is really good in those segments as this very shy young girl trying to rise to the occasion and be the person the public wants her to be.
All right, so that's Jackie coming out this weekend, starring Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy Bouvier Onassis, later Onassis.
Well done.
I want to take a minute, Rafer. You've seen a few minutes of Rogue One, the new Star Wars movie that's coming out. You're one of the few walking humans who's seen a little bit of this movie.
That is correct.
I can't believe it.
I was one of a select handful of journalists who was allowed to see about 20-25 minutes of the film.
Tell me everything.
They confiscated our phones. It was all very hush-hush. I couldn't even tell anyone that I'd been there for a few days. But now, Disney has lifted the veil. Don't cross Disney, Todd. Never cross Disney. I can't say what I've seen. I can't give my review yet, but I have seen the film, and so I know a little bit about it.
If it's awesome, give a silent thumbs up. I can report to takeaway listeners that I saw a thumbs up from Rafer Guzman. Rogue One. You didn't break a rule. You didn't say anything.
I don't think so.
That was all me. Rogue One is – I just wanted to get that out there because I know you've seen this. We're going to let you go. Let's get back to trivia really quickly. Now, there were some hints throughout the broadcast here. I asked you which famous JFK aide went on to become president of the Motion Picture Association of America. Rafer.
There was a little bit of a spoiler in that clip there. It's Jack Valenti.
It is Jack Valenti, indeed, and he was in that clip, and he was president of the MPAA for years and also an aide to Lyndon Johnson. And if you look at the famous photograph of Johnson taking the oath of office on Air Force One,
that's right.
Jack Valenti's in that photo. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
They told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. A newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum.
And what you're listening to there is, in my estimation, the greatest Christmas song of all time, but also the greatest alternative Christmas song, David Bowie, with Bing Crosby in 1977 for the Bing Crosby Merry Old Christmas special. It's just one of a big and expanding universe of alternative Christmas songs, and that's why Melissa Locker is here. She's culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, for us here at The Takeaway. And Melissa, you're writing about alternative Christmas songs for Elle magazine as well.
I sure am. You know, when you get tired of the AC/DC Christmas Carol, you can, you know, string up a couple other hits.
So I started us off with the greatest alternative Christmas song of all time, of course. Second greatest, Host Prerogative, of course, is the Ramones.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to bat tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to bat tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to bat tonight.
If you know the backstory about Joey and Johnny, this song is heartbreaking. It's like they just want to get along for a little while longer.
Yeah, they hated each other.
They really did.
Johnny stole his girlfriend and married her.
Yeah, and I mean, that's cold. That is not a Christmas present you want.
All right, with the Ramones, we can go from Queens. Let's go to Baltimore, to John Waters.
Hairspray took a lot of its inspiration from a Baltimore-era radio DJ show called The Buddy Dean Show, which the Corny Collins Show was based on. And Motormouth Maybell, who you may remember from Hairspray, she had a real-life person who inspired her named Paul Fat Daddy Johnson. And Paul Fat Daddy Johnson would host the monthly, what they called the Negro Hour, on The Buddy Dean Show in Baltimore. And he was a legend. And he helped create a Christmas song called Fat Daddy, which is featured on the John Waters Christmas compilation. And it's incredible.
I'm Fat Daddy, the reindeer boss. I pack my sleigh with goodies and toys.
This sounds almost like something Biz Markie could have done.
Yeah, and the fact that Biz Markie or Sir Mix-a-Lot has not covered this song is kind of a tragedy.
Melissa, I'm always happy whenever we talk about music in any form if we can land on the island of Tom Waits.
Charlie, I think I'm happy. The first time since my accident. I wish I had all the money we used to spend on dope.
Of course, that's Christmas Card from a Hooker in Minneapolis.
Tom Waits has one of the kind of classic barroom Christmas songs. Like, if you're going to end up in a bar or, you know, jail on Christmas Eve, you probably need to cue up some Tom Waits.
Big Star has kind of a Christmas song that you like.
They do. So in the middle of Big Star's third album, which is called Third, they put this song called Jesus Christ.
Royal David City was bathed in light and love. Jesus Christ was born today. Jesus Christ.
It's actually a really sweet, nice Christmas song. I don't know what Big Star was thinking, but they completely own the song.
Dee Snider and J.J. French were on this show years ago talking about their brand new Christmas album.
My son says that's the most threatening version of Chestnuts he's ever heard. You know, it actually sounds like it's a threat.
Chestnuts roasting.
Chestnuts will be,
yeah, they're going to get you.
Chestnuts will be roasted whether they want to be or not.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you don't know those guys, that's Twisted Sister. They got a record called Twisted Christmas. This is what it sounds like. Come on, Melissa, you with me?
I wish Dee Snider was here to celebrate Christmas with us.
So I think at this point people can form some kind of Spotify list of all these favorites that we've heard.
Yeah, I mean, why would you not want to play this at every single office party or holiday get-together? Or, you know, these songs may provide you some comfort and joy.
Well, we've played it before on this show many times. I'm sure we'll play it again. But David Bowie left this earth this year. And so I think even though we began with him, let's leave with Little Drummer Boy, David Bowie, Melissa Locker. Thank you.
Thank you.
So peace on earth. When we come, every child must be made aware. Every child.
We got a lot of suggestions from you, so we're going to take some time now to get to some of yours.
Hi, this is Phil from Boca Raton, Florida. I can't believe you forgot the best alternative Christmas song, Father Christmas by the Kinks. It rocks.
He said, Father Christmas, give us some money. Don't mess around with those silly toys. We'll beat you up, don't hand it over. We want your bread, so don't make us annoy. Give all the toys to the little rich boys.
We heard from Jennifer Murphy on Twitter, who suggested Robert Earl Keane's Merry Christmas from the Family.
Fran and Rita drove from Harlingen. I can't remember how I'm kin to them. But when they tried to plug their motor home in, they blew our Christmas lights.
We got some more on Twitter. Alex Dominguez says Christmas wrapping from the Waitresses.
Bah, humbug, that's too strong, 'cause it is my favorite.
Josh Copeland tweeted, Clean for Christmas from James Brown Christmas. This one's funky.
Hi, up in the morning, get my tie. Don't buy
Casey Musgraves came out with a Christmas album this year. This is Ribbons and Bows, maybe a new holiday super jam.
I don't need
You can always call us, 8778-MY-TAKER is our number. You can tweet us your favorite alternative holiday songs at The Takeaway or head over to our Facebook page. You know, I had a whole bunch. I had the Pogues. I had South Park. None of mine got in except the Bowie. That's the way it goes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.